Hello, this is Dr. Dan Kalish, and today we'll be mapping food cravings on the 15-minute matrix.
Welcome to the 15-minute matrix. I'm Andrea Nakayama, functional medicine nutritionist and your host. This is the podcast that brings you bite-sized insights and lessons on how to use the most important tool in functional medicine and functional nutrition. Today on the 15-Minute Matrix, I'm pleased to spend some time with my friend, Dr. Dan Kalish. Dr. Kalish is dedicated to teaching doctors functional medicine philosophy and practices. Through the Kalish Institute's educational programs, he has trained over 1,000 practitioners worldwide in the Kalish method, which solves patient challenges through a proven lab-based approach. Dr. Kalish is the author of 3 books, and over the past 25 years, he's directed 3 integrative health clinics in California, where he has coordinated teams of medical doctors, nutritionists, chiropractors, and acupuncturists. He now maintains an active international consultation practice with patients around the world. Hello and welcome, Dr. Kalish.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm so glad you're here because understanding food cravings and what they might indicate is such an important topic, and I'm excited to dive into this topic with you today. So can we just start by looking at the soup of the matter, or the central part of the functional nutrition matrix, where we can explore some of the physiological underpinnings of food cravings?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in my mind, there's a quick 3 response to that. One is the obvious blood sugar. One is, you know, just what people are eating and how they're controlling their blood sugar. One is things that are going wrong with your gut, with a, you know, yeast overgrowth typically, or something that's going to cause a carbohydrate craving most of the time. And then the third category, I think, is the most insidious, the most common, and the least understood, which is low levels of neurotransmitters leading to just a persistent hunger that won't go away regardless of what or how healthy the person is eating.
So if we're kind of moving our way around that central part of the matrix, you're talking about GI issues that might be indicated by a yeast overgrowth that is going to be tied back to a microbial imbalance. How would that manifest for a person?
In that category, there's a sort of constant need for something sugary, which feeds the, you know, unhelpful organisms or the yeast or fungal organisms, and at the same time physically displaces the commensular good bacteria that would otherwise keep things in check. And so, you know, you have, in fact, we were just looking at this research study the other day where when people are deprived of food for a certain number of hours, the microbiome actually responds in a really positive way. The healthy or commensal organisms do. They can withstand, you know, a lack of food supply for, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 hours, whereas some of the harmful organisms like yeast will be killed off. And so in a sense, you're feeding your microbiome by not eating food, and especially by not eating too much starchy carb or sugar.
That's really interesting to think that the cravings might be indicative. I mean, we know this. We know that the carbs feed the yeasts, but it's really interesting to look at it in terms of timing and think about the fact that if we get cravings in the middle of the night, let's say, or even in between meals, that it's because those yeast cells don't want to get killed off and they're saying, feed me, feed me, feed me.
Yeah, and in fact, by not feeding the yeast, you're encouraging the commensal or good bacteria to grow more healthily. And so, I mean, this is kind of, I think there's a flip side of the argument that I'm just learning about in the last couple of years working with Richard Lord, is that I've always been obsessed by killing the yeast, killing the parasites, blah, 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 dysbiosis. But what about the strengthening of the commensal bacteria? If you can strengthen the commensal bacteria sufficiently, you will displace the yeast organisms. You can even, you know, minimize or negate the effects of some of the harmful infections that we see in patients all the time. And you know, that's important.
I love this because it goes back to what we talk about in the functional nutrition lab community about terrain. So what you're talking about is if we feed the commensals, we actually shift the terrain in which the yeast overgrowth can occur.
Yeah, and that is primarily done with food, not with supplements. We're not talking about the best prebiotic supplement. We're talking about fiber from beans and polyphenols from fruits and vegetables, essentially.
Nice. So this kind of relates to the number one factor that you said can feed food cravings, which is blood sugar imbalances, which I would assume is pretty tied to the hormone and neurotransmitter arena as well. Can you talk into first the blood sugar, and then let's really dive into what I know is your area of expertise, which is the brain health in relation to the cravings?
Yeah, so I think there's real blood sugar fluctuations that cause cravings, and there's kind of fake out blood sugar cravings that cause cravings. So the real ones are, you know, you have a coffee and donut for breakfast, and that's just not a good idea. And then in the afternoon, you need your Snickers bar because you've destabilized your blood sugar and your insulin's wacky and your cortisol's wacky. And, you know, you're just having these blood sugar fluctuations, which cause you to want sugar. And that's kind of the obvious, eat three meals, have a little bit of protein with each meal and that kind of thing. And then there's something else that one of the doctors I've been working with recently calls a toxic hunger, which is, I think, actually even as common as a blood sugar problem, which is that we get so addicted to these toxic processed foods that we start to crave them. Mm. And it feels and looks a lot from a doctor's perspective, from my perspective, it feels and looks from the patient's side, it looks just like they're having a blood sugar problem. But really, they're having a sort of chemical-laden food-induced reaction. And so if they don't eat that chemically-induced food, chemically-laden in food for long enough, they get cravings. It's just like a cigarette smoker who hasn't smoked for a while. Right. They're going to crave a cigarette. And so that toxic hunger, as Dr. Furman calls it, I think is way more prevalent than I ever realized. Now that I've learned about it, it's something that I actually see all the time. And that ties into animal protein versus non-animal protein, other issues we probably won't talk about. But I think the toxic or hunger issue that Furman talks about is really essential. Are your patients addicted to and thinking that they're having blood sugar problems because of, you know, the chemical additives in foods?
Yeah, I mean, I see people who think they're having blood sugar issues for all different reasons that have to do with cellular receptivity and, you know, just even how they're able to process or utilize their sugars. And this is a really interesting one to think about toxic hunger. And it does relate right back to the neurotransmitter arena because we're tapping on the opiate receptors when we're in that realm of toxic hunger, right?
Yeah, and that's a craving that is as hard to resist as a drug craving would be for like heroin or something, right? This is not a negotiable craving. This is a I'm going to tear your head off if you don't give me the ice cream kind of craving, right?
Right. Yeah. So what else in that neurotransmitter arena, what's happening there that might induce food cravings?
Yeah, you know, I spent 12 years obsessing on that question, and I went into it thinking I was going to be primarily about serotonin. And I came out of that 12 years thinking, well, this is actually primarily about dopamine, if anything. And maybe that's a fine point, but it does make a difference in terms of what supplements you might select. But I find that the most craving-oriented people, the ones that find themselves suddenly at 2 a.m. in front of a refrigerator eating, and they like literally don't even know how they got there. You know, they're waking up at night.
Right.
Going to the refrigerator, or they call it night eating, I guess, and they're, you know, they're almost unconsciously eating perpetually, have the, you know, really serious problems with dopamine. And we measure that on organic acids testing, looking at homovanillate, which is a urinary byproduct of dopamine. But when those levels get really, really low, no matter what kind of meal you ate or how much you ate, you're just going to perpetually be hungry. It seems to affect people mostly once the sun goes down for a variety of reasons, I think. That maybe tie back a little bit to the serotonin, melatonin side of this. And if we can support those people with the precursors, the amino acids for serotonin and dopamine production, we really see radical changes almost instantaneously. I mean, sometimes in a few hours, certainly within a week.
It's really interesting. You know, I always think of dopamine as a neurotransmitter that's reliant on some of those fat-soluble vitamins. And you can start to think about how the diet itself is going to induce dopamine deficiency. And I actually think of our whole culture as dopamine deficient because we can't often see the long-term benefit of the short-term impact that we might have, the cause and effect there. You talked a little bit about the circadian piece with the cravings being higher in the evening. Is there anything else that you've seen over the years with cravings, times of day? I know I hear a lot from clients about cravings for sugar after dinner. What are those different times of the day about? Is there a way to look at it like that?
Yeah, definitely. I think that you can have that late afternoon dip, like around 4. That one's a little confusing because I think sometimes that is blood sugar related.
Right.
You can even relate back to breakfast and what they did or didn't do for breakfast.
Yeah.
And then the ones that seem to be dominated by neurotransmitters more often happen after dinner. And I've read a lot of different things about why that might be. I think, you know, a component of it may be because when it's dark, your melatonin levels are coming up and you're going to take all the available tryptophan that could convert into serotonin is going to be more, you know, directed towards the melatonin pathway. So you can have serotonin levels dipping as the sun goes down and it gets to be dark out. And then there is this pretty intimate relationship also, I think, between serotonin and dopamine anyways, in terms of the cravings. And so almost all the time when I've had good luck getting rid of the cravings completely that are neurotransmitter related, we do an element of support for both the dopamine and serotonin side. But I think it's the serotonin side that may be impacting that cyclical pattern a little bit more. Although, like I mentioned earlier, the really extreme cravings seem to be more responsive to the dopamine support.
And in that support that you're talking about, are you talking about supplemental, diet, lifestyle, all of the above? Any good takeaways that you could give us there?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that you can eat your way out of this one, other than that you have the obvious, make sure they have enough, you know, amino acids in their diet from protein. But
right.
I really don't think it's a dietary issue because I've seen a lot of healthy eaters with this problem, you know, healthy vegans, healthy paleo people, healthy everybody. So I don't think you can eat your way out of it. I think sometimes there are, back to the neurotoxic reason, you know, sometimes there's neurotoxins that are causing this disruption in the normal brain chemistry. Sometimes people are just born. I had a patient just yesterday who was born with an enzyme defect and she can't convert phenylalanine to tyrosine very well at all. And so we saw these really high phenylalanine levels on her labs, low tyrosine, and obviously as a consequence of that, it'd be very low dopamine. She was born like that, you know, so she had no role in this whatsoever. It's just the way it is for her brain and body. And so I think there's, you know, combinations of reasons why dopamine kind of stands out. And and you can't eat your way out of an enzyme defect
that's not
converting phenylalanine to tyrosine. You know, you're just kind of stuck with that. And some of these people, you know, have to supplement long term. It's more than just a couple months and then feeling better. They may be on some of these products, you know, for several years until the situation starts to balance itself out.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the story section of the Functional Nutrition Matrix, that left side, those ATMs, and you're talking about some antecedents there. Are there any other triggers or mediators that kind of pop out at you as common causes of food cravings? It sounds like yeast and low blood sugar and toxic hunger, those would all be triggers. Anything else that you see happening there?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the one that's ubiquitous and the one why, and one of the main reasons why I think we're seeing so many people gain so much weight consistently is because of the neurotoxin hypothesis, right? Where we're also laden now with so many hundreds of chemicals and heavy metals and whatnot that are damaging both the mitochondria, damaging neurons. And so we end up in these sort of fatigue/craving states as a result of, you know, actual physical damage to the neurons themselves. And, you know, as we test people and we see these patterns, one of the most common patterns that I see with patients that are dealing with these kind of hunger and weight issues is very poor glutathione level accompanied by very poor dopamine. Mm. And I don't think it's a mistake. You know, you see the chemicals and heavy metals destroying and just chewing up our glutathione system. And then as a result of that, the brain is relatively unprotected and the neurons are damaged even more. And then you get the abnormal firing, and then you get this. It's the same thing as if you didn't have enough dopamine. If the dopamine neurons are damaged, you end up with the same net effect, which is the hunger. And again, you can't eat your way out of that one either, right? Because you're talking about physical damage to the neurons.
Right.
And it has to be repaired. Yeah.
So we're talking about low glutathione, low dopamine. When it comes to cravings, are there any other nutrient deficiencies that you see acting as key players in cravings?
I have this personal fascination with pantothenic acid right now. You know how you go through stages in your career where you just think this one thing is like the most important thing?
Right.
And I'm kind of going through a phase of B5. But when you look at coenzyme A and its role in terms of, it's the key single block between, coenzyme A stands between effective mitochondrial burning of nutrients and the fat, protein, and carbs that are above it, right? When you look at all the charts.
Yeah.
So if you don't have acetyl-CoA, if you don't have pantothenic acid in sufficient amounts, you can't burn fat, protein, or carbohydrate at all. I mean, the citric acid cycle just can't move forward. And then you see the charts, if you look at charts for steroid hormone synthesis, right at the top of the chart, there's your CoA, right? So vitamin B5 is the initiator for production of all the steroid hormones. So I think that's a really key nutrient and I'm thinking of underutilized nutrients too, right? Like B5 doesn't get a lot of respect these days. I think that's, people, you always load people up on 500 milligrams of B5 twice a day. You don't really. And I think that's some of the other things are more obvious, whether it's chromium or lipoic acid or vanadium or those kind of things that we always associate with cravings. But I think B5 is one of the missing ones that you can get a lot of benefit from for people.
Nice. So final question, Dr. Kalish, I couldn't let you go today without talking a little bit about willpower, because I know we're looking at all these physiological reasons, and yet there still is a tendency to label food cravings and our ability to manage them with willpower. So how do you talk to patients about what's going on inside their bodies versus their willpower?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things. One is you really can't blame the victim, So if people have these physiological imbalances, like I said, it's like being a heroin addict. You're just going to be driven to do these things, and you're not really, willpower is not going to stop you from a low dopamine state, from eating excessively. It just won't. You can't. You may be able to do it for a few weeks at a time, but eventually people are going to crack. And then I think there's a bigger picture too, which is that, we all, myself included, eat in ways to undermine our total health potential and optimum feeling amazingness, right? I think for some reason, human beings have built into ourselves a default mechanism of, let's take it down a notch. I don't really feel totally comfortable being fully in my power. And I think that butter pecan ice cream looks pretty good to help me do that.
That's right.
And so I think that, I don't know if you want to call that willpower, it's more like, how we slow ourselves down.
Yeah, it's kind of the flip side.
Yeah, and I think that's okay that we do that. But at the same time, I think if we recognize that we do that, that we can stop doing it and realize, well, wait a minute, maybe I just put the spoon down and I don't do the ice cream, and I'm just going to sit here and feel my feelings and be more of who I am versus numb out,
Yeah, so there's a lot to explore there in terms of the behavior and what's happening in that moment, what's leading to that impulse to take a bite of the butter pecan ice cream or whatever it may be. Thank you so much, Dr. Kalish.
You're welcome.
The 15-Minute Matrix is brought to you by me, Andrea Nakayama, and the Functional Nutrition Alliance. The 15-Minute Matrix team includes my son, Gilbert Nakayama, on sound production, Renee Hunt, Natalie Merrill, and Christine Shook. Please do take the time to leave a review of the podcast anywhere you listen, and particularly on iTunes. When you do so, it'll help me to reach new listeners, grow the show, enable me to keep putting out the content that you enjoy, and to further advance our shared mission to change the way we do healthcare with the practices and principles of functional medicine and functional nutrition. You can also visit us at anytime and hear more episodes at 15minutematrix.com. And if you'd like to be notified each time there's a new podcast episode, please go to 15minutematrix.com/notify. Give us your name and email, and we'll send you a super short note to let you know that a new podcast is ready for you and a little bit about the topic of that week's episode. You have an open invitation to email us. We want to know who you'd like to hear on the podcast and what you'd like to see mapped on the 15-Minute Matrix. You can email us at ask@15minutematrix.com. That's ask@15minutematrix.com. Thanks so much for listening.